conference.
Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Today's call is also being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn today's meeting over to your host, Mr. Scott Woods. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for Broadband USA's monthly webinar on broadband topics and issues of interest to the public. My name is Scott Woods, and I manage Broadband USA's Technical Assistance Program, and I will be moderating today's webinar. Our topic today is Public-Private Partnerships, Delivering Solutions for America's Communities. As we all know, broadband is critical to the economic development and vitality of communities across the United States. Given its importance, state and local leaders are exploring how to expand the availability and adoption of robust, high-quality, and affordable broadband services in their communities. To reach these goals, many have utilized public-private partnerships. While no partnership structure is exactly like another, there are some common models and best practices that communities should research before embarking upon a broadband partnership. The best approach for a particular community will depend upon several factors specific to each community. To help us navigate and discuss this topic, our presenters today are Kara Cybernagel, Management Analyst with Pitkin County, Colorado, and Evan Biaggi, Vice President of Colorado Operations for Mammoth Networks, Incorporated. We have Mr. James Fortune, who's the Town Administrator for Town of Cranberry Isles, Maine, and Mark Ouellette, the President of Axiom Technologies, Incorporated, and Dennis Gakonga, Chief Sustainability Officer, Economic Development Department for the City of Chula Vista, California. Unfortunately, one of our planned speakers had an emergency and will not be able to join us. But before we begin, I would like to review a few governing instructions. First, we will open up the webinar for questions after the completion of the presentations. Please use the question box on the right-hand side of the screen to submit any questions or comments you may have. Second, the presentations, along with a transcript and recording of today's session, will be available on the Broadband USA website within 7 days of this webinar under the Events/Broadband USA Webinar Archives tab. As a reminder, our Broadband USA website also provides you with information about our technical assistance program, guides, products, and publications, and other tools that can assist you with the planning, funding, and implementation of your broadband project. As we begin, our first speakers, Kara Cybernagel and Evan Biaggi, have formed a public-private partnership for Pitkin County's broadband initiative in rural Colorado. Kara serves as a management analyst for Pitkin County and is responsible for the planning, coordination, and implementation of a wide range of community and organizational projects. She works closely with the county's leadership and the Board of County Commissioners to develop and maintain policy strategies and activities for local, state, and federal issues. Evan is the Vice President of Colorado Operations for Mammoth Networks, where he is focused on growing the company by developing public-private partnerships and rural broadband expansion. Prior to joining Mammoth Networks, Evan was the president of Resort Broadband LLC and was responsible for everything from supporting the technology to making daily operation decisions. Please welcome Kara and Evan.
Thank you, Scott. This is Kara Cybernagel, and I just wanted to give you all a little more background on Pitkin County before we get started. As Scott mentioned, Pitkin County is located in rural Colorado, western Colorado, with Aspen as the county seat. So we're traditionally known as a rural resort area. So 90% of our county is actually comprised of public lands. And yet we have a population of just under 18,000, with over half of that concentrated in the city of Aspen. but our visitation numbers during peak seasons, being a resort area, can skyrocket to 30,000 daily during summer and winter seasons. So in 2011, we received a mandate from our voters to begin exploring the expansion of broadband services, primarily through the rural area. And through that, we have established, through the Board of County Commissioners, the Pickens County Broadband Initiative. Next slide. So this map shows an area of what's known as the Roaring Fork Watershed. Actually, Pickens County is just the bottom two-thirds of that map, but because of how you get to Pickens County, and I'm sure many people know that broadband doesn't recognize political boundaries. So our entire Pickens County Broadband Initiative has generally been focused on the full Roaring Fork watershed. And as we went through this, we've learned that we've had fiber cuts that have cut off the entire region, as well as several rural areas with difficult terrain and low population areas that have left much of the county underserved or unserved. And so as we went through this, in 2014, the county completed a needs assessment, which really highlighted the dramatic difference between the haves and the have-not throughout the watershed. The blue area on this map shows the main highway, State Highway 82, where we have fiber connectivity that really connects us to the rest of the state. The red area shows all the various drainages and population areas throughout the rest of the region that have little to no access to broadband connectivity. And so as we went through this, we really prioritized our efforts and said, let's focus on those underserved and unserved areas, as well as building up some resiliency along that highway corridor so that when there are those fiber cuts, that we've built up a redundant, resilient backhaul that can help support the entire region. Next slide. So through the needs assessment, Pickens County established the following goals and objectives. The main one being, we didn't want to overbuild any kind of project. We wanted to establish a middle mile network that can facilitate private investment. Pickens County did not want to be a broadband provider, but how could we leverage the existing infrastructure, the assets that we owned, to really bring in the private investors or the private providers to feed those underserved areas? Along the lines, we also established and heard from our constituents that any network, we needed to maintain affordability, abundancy, redundancy, and resiliency, and have kept that as kind of our mantra throughout this entire project. Next slide. So as you can see, this is a rough schematic of our middle mile project. The idea is that we would lease backhaul from the main existing fiber network and provide it up to our tower locations and establish a microwave middle mile network that, again, enhances the redundancy built into the entire middle mile network. From that microwave middle mile that the county owns, we would then use a network operator to help us provide those last mile services and reach out to the ISPs to provide end of services to the homes. Next slide. So the county's approach was that we were looking for a four-layer approach where there's the network owner. We would be the owner of all the infrastructure, but would work with a network operator to really help us manage the middle mile network, but even more importantly, being a government, that having a partner through this as a network operator can help facilitate those partnerships and relationships with the private market and the ISPs. So Pickens County went to RFP last fall, in August, I believe, and we had a few responses for a network operator, and through that RFP process, we selected Mammoth Networks. And so from there, I'm going to hand it over to Evan with Mammoth to speak a little bit more about the approach since we've gone in through the RFP process.
Thank you, Kara. Everyone, my name is Evan Biaggi with Mammoth Networks. And as the network operator in this project, We have gone through quite a great deal of work to develop a model that we feel is going to be sustainable in the long term and also meet the goals and objectives for Pitkin County. And while we're on this slide, I'm just going to touch on a few more details of what the four-layer approach is. Starting with the network owner, this obviously is Pitkin County, and they made a determination early on that they're not in the broadband business, but they wanted to play a role. The network operator, as we've talked about, our main focus is really running and building this network. We're responsible for the installation, provisioning, daily operations. And really, we're doing this in such a way that it creates an open access network for other service providers. The network provider's role is the folks that really bring things into the network, the middle mile providers. They could be things as well as voice providers or IP television services. So there may be additional network providers that come into the network to utilize this open access network to get their content or their services out to the areas throughout Pitkin County. And then finally, the service providers. These are the last mile service providers, the ISPs, if you will, that are going to have the direct relationships with the residential and business customers. They'll be the face of the project from a public perspective, and they're going to play a vital role in the overall project. Next slide, please. So in order to make this work for everyone involved, we've decided to work out a revenue share model for compensation for all of the different stakeholders. Starting from the right-hand side of this graphic, you've got the end user. They're going to sign a contract and sign up for service with a last-mile provider. That last-mile provider is then going to take a portion of that revenue and move it along to the network operator, who will then carve out a piece for the network owner. This network or this revenue share model, we feel, is a good way to incentivize all of the different parties for their respective roles in the project. The numbers shown here are just preliminary but represent how this model would work. And at the end of the day, the goal, the underlying goal in all of this is to have the most customers as possible to bring in the most revenue. That's really going to be the true telltale sign of a successful project. Next slide, please. As we began to engage with Pitkin County on this, we had some high-level strategic ideas of what we wanted to accomplish, but we really needed to get down to a tactical plan. And internally, we've been referring to this tactical plan as a project blueprint, so to speak. And there have been a number of phases that go along with developing this blueprint. The first stage and one of the most important stages is really data analysis. Any good plan starts with a good amount of data. And we've crunched a ton of data in this project and looked at things like coverage maps and correlating that information to GIS address points to develop a comprehensive financial analysis for the project. The financial modeling has also been there's been a great deal of time going into the financial modeling. We've got detailed modeling for both capital expenses and operating expenses, and we've broken that out based on which capital expenses are the responsibility for the network owner, which expenses are the responsibility of the network operator. And through that process, we have worked collaboratively to ensure that both needs are met to come up with a financial model that is sustainable for the project as a whole, but also meets the needs and objectives for each of the parties involved. After we've come up with that, we're actually right now in the funding phase of this project. We're looking at various funding sources, grant funds, loan programs, you name it, as well as determining labor and support expenses. There are a number of funding sources that are available both at the federal and state level, and we are looking to leverage dollars as best as we can to help, again, make this financial model as successful as possible. Finally, once all of that is done, we move on to the deployment phase, which is the fun part. And at that point, we look forward to finalizing a network operator agreement and begin service deployment here this summer and into the fall. Next slide, please. So this is just a quick map that shows some of our coverage analysis that we have done throughout this process. And as Kara mentioned before, if anyone knows this area, it is quite rugged. The terrain that we're trying to cover is very difficult, and there are a ton of these drainages, as we've been calling them, where it's very difficult to provide access. And certainly with this project, we've focused on wireless as being the technology best suited to accommodate the highest number of folks for improving their broadband service. And our projections are currently showing around 90% of all addresses in the area will be covered with our phased plan and our initial approach. We are continuing to work on building out secondary and tertiary towers to further improve these projections, but that's where we are right now from a planning perspective. And this map does show household addresses as well as proposed tower sites. A number of these proposed tower sites are already in existence. They are Pitkin County-owned towers that are also doubling as public safety sites. And utilizing resources that are already in place is a great way to help push a project like this forward. Next slide, please. Finally, this slide does show just a high-level logical diagram of what this network would look like. We have gone through a bunch of the existing Pitkin County sites have been identified as what we're considering primary towers. Primary towers would then feed secondary towers that would also be Pitkin County-owned sites. But those secondary towers are going to be much smaller scale, will not have other services on there, such as public safety and even translator services and whatnot. And a big portion of this project has been identifying sites that could be used for secondary towers that meet land use and are, you know, technically in good locations for RF propagation. So the important thing to note here on this slide is really this plan, along with the phasing of how this network would come together, was truly a collaborative approach. You know, very important to get down into the trenches and sit down in a room together and work out the details to get down to this level of detail. And let's move on to the last slide. At the end of the day, I just want to close here with saying that we're really excited to be working with Pitkin County as their private partner in this project and look forward to a successful deployment and feel that the comprehensive planning that we've all undergone is going to help get us there. We are big proponents of the public-private partnership here and really feel that this is a project that will be very successful. With that, I'll send it back to Scott.
Thank you very much, Kara and Evan. As a reminder, we will have time for questions at the end of the session. Please use the question box on the right-hand side of your screen to submit questions and or comments, and we'll do our best to get to all of them at the end of the session. Also, as a reminder, copies of this webinar and the presentations therein will be available on our website within 7 days of the webinar. Our next speakers, Mr. James Fortune and Mark Ouellette, have formed a public-private partnership for Cranberry Isles Broadband Project in Maine. James, or Jim Fortune, is the town administrator for the town of Cranberry Isles, where he oversees all of the town's management functions, in particular the construction and deployment of the town's broadband project. Mr. Mark Ouellette is the president of Axiom Technologies, and his chief responsibilities are overseeing and growing Axiom's internet and wireless businesses. Mark has held a number of senior leadership positions in the state of Maine. Most recently, He served as the executive director of Mobilize Maine, where he worked with the regions across the state to help develop and implement a measurable private sector economic deployment and development strategies. Please welcome James and Mark.
Thank you, Scott. I'll start for myself and Mark. Yes, I'm James Fortune. I'm town administrator for Cranberry Isles. And some facts about the community. We're a coastal community, five islands off the coast of Maine. And we have a year-round population of about 140 people with a summer population that can be up around 800 during the peak season. And we're a little isolated community, very small geographic area, but quite isolated in terms of and remote in terms of our location, about 3 to 4 miles off the coast. Next slide, please. What the town did 2 years ago is it felt a need to improve the internet and broadband service that we had available on the islands that were actually available only on two of the islands, the two that are have year-round populations. The other island that has only a summer population of about 25 to 30 homes really didn't have any type of service at all for internet service. And other than telephone service. So there was a need felt in the community that we needed to improve over the wireless service that we had at the time. While we were in this process, we had an unfortunate situation where the wireless company, which was housing its equipment in a private residence in a tower, didn't come to an agreement about continuing that use of that had been, I think, about 7 or 8 years. So the equipment had to be removed, which was going to leave a large portion of the town, not all of it, but a large portion of it, without any service at all for internet service. So the town certainly felt there was a crisis and a certain sense of urgency around that we were going to be without service after about a year. So we had to sort of speed up our process with this committee of town residents and ended up, it turned out that we couldn't really find a provider that could step in, primarily due to our remote location and the fact that we really don't have a large number of homes out here that could support that service. So we, what the town did is supported a process to develop an RFP to find a service provider that would provide us what we felt we needed for service. And we wanted to build something. We wanted to go beyond the antiquated wireless service that we'd been using and was becoming less and less helpful and beneficial to the residents over time. So we wanted to build something for the future. So we put out an RFP for a system that would be built for the future, and we decided on a fiber to the home network, which is we felt that was the way to go. That would get us down that road where we wanted to be. And the reasons for that, there was a lot of support in the community for that. It was overwhelming support, actually, after we went through this process. We ended up, we got 3 responses, ultimately, in our request for proposals. And only one, which was Axiom, met all of the criteria that we were looking for. Others sort of met it halfway or really were offering something different that we didn't feel was... They would have only been a stopgap measure. We would have to revisit this at some point. But the overwhelming support with the community, once we went to vote with the town to approve funds to actually do the project, out here in a remote location like this, it was felt that there was a need to preserve the island way of life. We do have a fairly stable population, but we do want to attract new island residents and families. We're actually close enough to the mainland that you can commute back and forth, but it's not an easy task. So we wanted people to be able to live out here and work out here, and felt that this connection with this broadband service would be that lifeline to the mainland. It was also a way of preserving our economy and helping not necessarily to grow the economy in the area, but to preserve and to sustain what we have in long term. It definitely was an issue for summer visitors and residents. A lot of these residents were really interested in getting getting the service up and running, primarily because they many people will come here, they'll bring their work here and try to work here through the weeks or a few months in the summer, and that was becoming more and more difficult. And if the island lost service altogether, it would be impossible to do. So we embarked on that effort to find a provider that could build the system for us, went through a process, selected Axiom, and you'll hear from Mark in a moment, and ultimately that's what we went with, and we're in the process now of building out this fiber to the home. We've done one island already, and starting this spring we will do the other two islands, one of the other year-round island with year-round residents and also the one with summer residents. And with that, Mark, I'll hand it over to you, and you can talk about some of the processes that you guys used for our build-out and working with the town.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Next slide, please. So just briefly, this was the process that we used. This is a process that we use with rural communities across Maine and actually now beyond to help them work through a process of assessing, defining their goals, and planning and implementing, and that's where we are in the process with Jim and the community of Cranberry Isles. Next slide, please. So really, I wanted to just really do a little bit of a dive into the public-private partnership that we developed with Jim and with the community, because I think really this speaks to the heart of how a public entity like the town and a private entity like ourselves can really come together. And as Kara and Evan were describing in their project, we went through a process where this is really defining what each side of the partnership would look like, what would we commit to on the private side, and what would the public side commit to. So from our perspective, it was very important and I think somewhat unique, although I think this happens in other places, that we commit to the town of returning some gross revenue back to the town over time on a yearly basis to really show our commitment to the community, and show them that we're in for the long haul, that we want to support them, and that they would control a fund that they could do something with as they moved along. Second, that we really wanted to commit some percentage of our labor or of our time and effort to this construction to try to keep costs down and to work very uniquely in how we delivered the construction to portion of our efforts to the communities. Very important that we work very closely together on that. And then several other things here that we can talk about in the question and answer period if you like. Next slide, please. On the public side, of course, the easy thing to say is, hey, they committed $1.3 million to build this system, a very, very heavy lift for a small community. And really, to Jim's point, really showed their commitment to getting essentially world-class fiber broadband to their community that was going to have a shelf life of well over 20 years, and that's what we're committed to building with them. And so from their perspective, beyond the money piece and figuring out how we were going to pay, and there were several iterations of trying to figure out how to pay for this, ultimately the town is bonding $1.3 million. And that bonding mechanism, I think you looked at our interest of less than interest percentage of bonding of less than 3%, correct, Jim? I can't remember. 2.5 to 3%. Really, the cost of the money is almost free from a interest rate standpoint. And has been a very, very obviously helped us building out the network. They also work very closely with us on making sure, and I think for every project, understanding utility rights of ways, where the property boundaries are, how sensitive people in communities are to pole and cable placement, and making sure that the town was a really deeply true partner throughout the process was especially helpful. Jim talked a lot about putting together a broadband committee that had started talking about this 2 years before, and I think that ended up being really paying off as we went through the process. Next slide, please. So just to mention a couple of issues, you see a picture of a tower there. I don't know how other people are in other parts of the country, and Mammoth and Evan can speak to this directly also. People are getting sensitive to tower bills, and certainly on this island, the tower and where the placement of the tower was a significant issue that needed to be overcome. This tower that you see being built here is being built finally after a couple of sites were looked at on town land. So one issue was really making sure that we had sort of the all of the permitting and all of the thing and all of the public actions that needed to take place to build the tower. Secondly, we put up a number of new poles and a lot of new poles in the utility right away. And those placements of the poles were very sensitive to a lot of residents, and we had to overcome and do a lot of community outreach to make that process work. I already mentioned the placement of the tower, and then lastly, Sutton Island, the third island, which is a completely private island, summer island. We originally proposed a point-to-multipoint wireless RF system for them, and they came back and said, "We really want fiber." What a surprise! So we ended up having to change our project scope a little bit to accommodate the folks on Sutton Island. And we're now moving towards essentially equal access for all. Everybody on every island is going to have access to the same levels of speeds and the same type of technology being used. So just very quickly, I'll end with some next slide, please. Some ingredients for success from our perspective, and we've been dealing with a lot of communities, a lot of remote communities. And for those of you who want to ask me a question at the end of this about whether or not the New England Patriots are cheaters or not, you can certainly do that. But I wanted to just mention first, from rule number one, that you need to have a champion, and it's extremely important that the community be heavily involved to make these public-private partnerships work. And Jim mentioned it, and I've mentioned it again, and I'll put an emphasis on it, having a broadband committee really committed and really coming to the table on a weekly, monthly, bi-monthly basis to talk about how to be successful and the kinds of goals that they were trying to attain were extremely important. Next slide, please. Rule number two, I call my Lady Gaga rule. New song by Lady Gaga. I've got 100 million reasons to walk away. I just need one good one to stay. You know, good goals will carry you through the negativity. And for every project, there are going to be people who come out of the woodwork and have 100 million reasons why something's not going to work. And I think the committee and the town and Axiom did a really good job of really pushing through that negativity and really emphasizing all of the positive things and the goals that the town was trying to reach. So establishing those goals were an essential ingredient. Next slide, please. And ingredient number three was really not to muddle and bog down a project by talking about money first, about how expensive it was going to be, and really getting through setting up that broadband committee, getting those goals set, and really trying to understand what it is we're trying to achieve as a community, and how are we going to partner with that private partnership, and how are we going to move this forward. Once you do that, I think, then you can talk about money and how to achieve those goals. And by doing that, I think, not just in this project, but in many other projects we work with, by putting money aside and just really focusing on what you want to do, you're going to be successful in the long run. So next slide, please. So there we are, our contacts, and the picture is from the tower that you saw being built, and you can see the wireless microwave link. This is on Islesford, looking out over the bay, and that little dish is the wireless link that you see in the back left-hand, top left-hand corner. Thank you, and I'll turn this over back to Scott.
Thank you, James and Mark. I really appreciate that. Last and not least, our final speaker is Dennis Gukunga. Dennis is the Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Chula Vista, California, and leads the city's Office of Sustainability and Smart City Campaign. His responsibilities include managing the implementation of a wide range of sustainability programs and smart city initiatives. His previous experience includes serving as a department director and assistant director for multiple municipalities and public agencies in both Texas and California. Please welcome Dennis Gukunga.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning. For those of us on the West Coast, it's good morning, and those on the East Coast, good afternoon. I'm very excited to get this opportunity to share with you about our Smart City Strategic Action Plan, and then have that serve as a backdrop to talking about what we're doing around public-private partnerships. So before I begin, let me give you just a quick overview about the city of Chula Vista. We're a city of about 268,000 people. We're the second largest city in San Diego County. We're the second largest, 76th largest city in the United States. And we're located 15 minutes from downtown San Diego, as well as 15 minutes from the busiest border crossing in the world between the United States and Mexico. Next slide, please. So a smart city essentially is, we've defined it as, you know, about leveraging technology and data analytics and techniques to improve our city operations, better serve and engage our residents, advance sustainability goals, and promote economic development. And it begins with a robust networking and communication platform, which will allow us to deploy state-of-the-art sensor networks and data tools that we can take advantage of. Next slide, please. So why is this important? We see our Smart Cities Plan as a huge opportunity to maximize taxpayer dollars when we increase the efficiency and effectiveness of city operations and services, including public safety. And smart technology will also help us lay the groundwork for economic development and also offer new revenue generation opportunities that didn't exist before. As a chief sustainability officer, a smart city is a sustainable city, and a sustainable city is a smart city. So in many ways, Chula Vista's smart city goals and sustainability goals complement each other, and there's an opportunity to leverage both for greater results. And finally, through our smart cities, we will be able to really open up the walls of City Hall and engage our residents in ways that we could only have dreamt of a few years ago. Next slide, please. So there are many drivers that led to the adoption of our Smart City Strategic Action Plan. But one of the main ones was a recent 10-year housing sales tax ballot measure that was approved by the voters, which will allow us to upgrade our outdated traffic signal systems and IT infrastructure. Next slide, please. So in September of last year, we developed our Smart City Strategic Action Plan, as I mentioned, and it was adopted by City Council. And this was our roadmap to help us get to accomplishing our vision. The plan is built around 10 primary objectives organized into four broad overarching goals. And each objective has a number of initiatives or action steps. Next slide, please. So it's really important as we're, you know, as we're talking about public-private partnerships, that we also articulate that our plan requires us to focus on regional collaboration and partnerships in order to accomplish our vision. To quote this proverb, we don't want to go fast, we really want to go far. So we need to make sure that we're relying on these regional partnerships to ensure that our smart cities initiatives are sustained by stakeholder engagement across our region. Next slide, please. So our first goal is to become a connected city. This goal has two major ideas. The first, that the city has a municipal fiber ring that connects all city facilities. And second, that the public is also connected. And this is where we'll be focusing on the digital divide by making sure that everyone has access to the internet. We'll also be incorporating smart city philosophy into our policy documents to make it clear that the city is committed to being a smart city. So what are we doing with regards to this goal around public-private partnerships? Currently, we're working with GE on a pilot program for adaptive lighting. And we've deployed 18 locations over the past 5 months. And in early April, we'll be launching another smart lighting pilot project. We're also very excited about our partnership with Cisco and NIC Partners on our citywide network upgrade project where we anticipate that the city will save approximately $900,000. This includes Cisco providing state-of-the-art IoT sensors to the city to begin testing various sensor platforms. Next slide, please. Our next goal is for Chula Vista to become a responsive city, and this is important to highlight that it's not just about working for our residents, but also working with our residents. Some key objectives include community engagement, stronger intergovernmental relations, and economic development. And we're looking to establish a regional smart city working group to identify opportunities in the region, as well as continuing to engage local businesses to identify smart city priorities. The city recently launched our ThinkBit Lab Innovation Station in collaboration with Qualcomm, who, as you may know, are headquartered here in the San Diego region, and the Chula Vista Elementary School District. This innovation station, located in our central library, creates a space where Chula Vista students and residents of all ages can collaborate on projects, invent, explore, and help to discover. In addition, as part of our Smart Cities efforts, the city established an innovation council consisting of several industry leaders, including Qualcomm, Cisco, Black & Veatch, and OSI Soft, to help with our efforts. This innovation council was coordinated by Cleantech San Diego, which is an organization that brings together IoT vendors and businesses in our region. I also represent the city by serving on the board of Cleantech San Diego. Next slide, please. Our third goal is to become a transparent city, and a key objective for this goal is to use data and analytics to improve city services, as well as increasing public access to city KPIs. The city is spending hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars, so it's important for them to be able to open up the hood and see how we're performing with regards to our taxpayer dollars. So we've recently partnered with Results for America under the What Works Cities to develop an open data program. Right now, we're focused mainly on public safety, and we hope to expand that across the city. We see a huge opportunity here for public-private partnerships because city data is valuable. So one of the things that we'll be focusing on is how do we package this data in a format that is attractive and useful for businesses. Next slide, please. Our final goal is to be an innovative city. The Chula Vista Bayfront is one of our biggest opportunities. This is the largest fully entitled waterfront development opportunity on the west coast of the United States. And the vision is to use this bayfront as a test bed for smart city applications and then scale that up to other parts of the city. So there's also an opportunity here to think about sensors and smart technology as a way of facilitating our sustainability efforts, including, you know, smart irrigation controllers, building management systems, air pollution monitoring devices, and so on and so forth. We recently have partnered on a smart waste management pilot program where we've deployed sensors on most of all our trash cans on city bus stops. And the idea here is to provide us some use the technology and data analytics to help us optimize and maximize on our route and collection routes. We also have received a grant and developed a water stewardship plan to help address some of the critical challenges around the drought that, this region and our city has experienced. And we also worked with our park and rec and some partners to deploy a smart irrigation system on two of our parks, which was very well received by the community. And finally, Chula Vista will continue to be a leader in using technology to advance public safety through our efforts on the autonomous vehicle proving grounds that was launched by the U.S. DOT. Next slide, please. So in conclusion, as a city, we're very excited in the direction that we're heading, and we're really looking forward to maximizing and taking advantage of all the opportunities that present themselves for private-public partnerships.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you all for your time and presentations today. We will now open the webinar up from questions from our attendees. The first question, I'll ask this to the group and we'll go in order. What was the biggest mistake or obstacle that attendees can avoid in the partnership selection process? Kevin and, sorry, Kara. And Evan, you want to start with that, and then we'll go down the line.
Sure. I can start, and I think Evan can speak to this a little bit as well. But when we started down this path through the RFP process, we had envisioned, we, the county, had envisioned that we were going to RFP for a network operator. As we went through the proposal process and really had some follow-up questions specifically with Mammoth on their proposal, I think we both came to an agreement that the assumptions that we had, the information that we had at that point in time, neither one of the parties felt comfortable enough entering into an agreement given the risks and the assumptions that were still at play, and that's actually how we came to agreement that we're going to go through this tactical planning process rather than just signing a contract and agreeing to be a network owner-operator relationship, and that really the assumptions that you know it's hard to be able to dive into further without already having more information. And maybe Evan can speak a little bit about how we kind of came to that idea of using this tactical plan before actually getting to contract.
Yeah, I think we had an idea of what Pitkin County wanted to accomplish. And in the RFP, you know, RFPs are very difficult from a responder's perspective because you have a general understanding of what your response should be. But getting down to the details of putting a number to what our compensation would be in a situation like this was very difficult to do without having all of the details in front of us and having developed a very comprehensive financial plan. And within the 30-day RFP window, for us to develop that entire plan and present that without any sort of formal engagement that we would ultimately become the network operator is a daunting task. It's a lot of work, and it was beyond what we felt we would be able to actually provide. So we feel that this intermediary step of working collaboratively as the chosen person to become the network operator has worked really well for us to iron out the details and really hone in what that business plan is going to look like so that we are both covered from a monetary and commitment level.
Thank you, thank you. So Jim and Mark, do you want to address that in terms of the mistakes or obstacles attendees can avoid in the partnership selection process?
Sure. You want me to go, Mark?
Yeah, go right ahead, Jim.
From our perspective, for Cremorales, we're fairly small, geographically small, so we had some limitations regarding that. But we, from our perspective, like I said, we, in my presentation, we've been working towards something for about a year, and then maybe a little less than a year. And then we're suddenly faced with sort of an ultimatum, in a sense. We had to do it very quickly, and we had to seek a lot of assistance from not necessarily state organizations necessarily, but we have access to an organization called the Island Institute, which supports various projects and things to sustain island communities off the coast of Maine. There aren't too many left. They have year-round populations, and so that they were a huge help in that. So I think enlisting the assistance. If you have a broadband committee, we're all lay people. A couple of people had some familiarity with how this stuff works. Most of us did not. We were learning as we went along how this should work. But we sought out technical assistance and other assistance through other organizations, and it was all very helpful to us. But ultimately, we had to do this in a very tight time frame to get it all ready and get it out and get responses back, tabulate what that was and figure out how it's all going to look and work and what the budget's going to be. We had a very short window to do this, but it was a pretty big effort and a lot of heavy lifting. I know it consumed a lot of my time over the winter last year into March. Anyway, For small communities like ours, getting that outside assistance was very important. There was another community, an island community in Maine, that was actually ahead of us in this effort. They had started this on their own, I think, a year or two earlier. So we had some framework to work with and some experience on their part. But, yeah, I think it's getting that outside help with understanding what we're dealing with, to sort of present this to people to make a decision about, do we want to spend this kind of money on this particular project? Is this the right way to go? And ultimately, that's what the community made the decision to go in that direction.
I'll just briefly say, Scott, that typically RFPs throw in the kitchen sink, and to echo Evan's comment, we as a provider or a responder to an RFP typically are very challenged to be able to respond, because most communities want everything and they would like it for nothing. So we as a provider and we really need to balance out, and I commend Tara and Evan for doing what they did. It's clearly a trust, it becomes a trust issue between the provider and the community to work closely together, and that's really what happened in the Cranberries when we responded. So I think it's very important when you think about RFPing things that you're very careful about what your expectation is through that RFP process.
And if I could also just add to that, when you're thinking about a litmus test in terms of trying to identify the right partners, it's really important to have a different frame of mind in terms of how you're looking at, whether it's smart cities or deployment of various technologies. It's not really just about what the technology can do, but really what do stakeholders want. So you're really not seeking technology partners. You're really seeking folks who are uniquely positioned with end users and understand their needs, because that's hugely critical for as you move forward and try to ensure that you're successful in your initiative.
Okay, thank you all for those responses. I have a next question is specifically for the Pitkin County Mammoth Network team. The question is, why are there four layers instead of three layers, particularly when you have a 50-45-5% revenue split?
Sure, this is Evan. I can answer that. There are a number of three-layer models out there, and I don't think that there's a problem with the three-layer model. We introduced the fourth layer, and really the fourth layer is the network provider layer. So the three-layer model would be network owner, network operator, service provider. The fourth layer is adding in that network provider. And the network provider, at least in this case, they're getting their revenues based on the middle mile that they're providing to the network. So they're going to get paid as in a flat fee for whatever services the network is purchasing. Part of the process is figuring out, is the network owner paying for it? Is the network operator paying for it? But at the end of the day, they're not necessarily cut into the revenue, because those services are provided on a flat fee basis for that service, as opposed to being part of that revenue split. Certainly, there may be another model where a revenue share might include that network provider, but in the case for Pitkin County, we've decided not to include that. Hopefully that helps answer that question, but happy to answer further questions on that topic if needed.
Okay. Thank you. Our next question is for the broadband projects. And Dennis, you could probably would appreciate your insight on this question as well from the city's perspective, from a large area perspective. The question is, how do you deal with inaccurate coverage maps and the references to the FCC data? And how do you document and present accurate data to potential funders and or partners? Can we start with the Cranberry Isles Park? And Jim, can you take that on?
I'm sure. I'm going to have to ask you to repeat that question, though, if you wouldn't mind.
The question is with respect to inaccurate coverage maps, or how do you present accurate coverage data to potential funders and or partners?
Well,
with Cranberry Isles, I'm sure with the minimal homes per island, it was fairly easy. But for you,
right,
generally, what were some of the sources that you looked at? Did you do any sort of pre deployment planning, any studies anything that would show coverage beyond reliance on publicly available data?
I would say in our case, no. Our geography is fairly limited. It's three islands, and there is a great deal of local knowledge, our own mapping and our own local knowledge of where things are. And so we actually didn't have to do any pre-engineering of this. Axiom, and I'll let Mark speak to this, did all of that on their own. We just gave them parameters of what we were looking for. And Mark said that can prove difficult for the provider to respond to because we're asking for a lot. But we didn't have to go out and do a great deal of pre-engineering of this. We just had to get a basic plan in place of where things were going to go. And some of it, particularly because we were had a very tight window of getting this underway, for at least for one of our year-round islands, some of it was a process we learned as we went along. We mapped out some things, what we wanted to do, and where things were going to go, but we've had to make adjustments along the way. The other two islands, we had more time, so we'll be able to learn from some of those mistakes that we made on our phase one, and we'll avoid some of those in the other phase. But again, a lot of it was really based on local knowledge. We didn't really have to do a lot of pre-engineering in our case, and probably due to our small geography, we don't have we're not a large area.
But I'll just say from my perspective, and we've done a lot of projects across Maine, and this won't necessarily pertain to cranberries, but very quickly, I'd say working with your understanding and working with your local providers who are already in the network or in your area, and having them talk to you about where their coverage area is an important first step to sort of either testing those maps, those national maps, and or saying to them, hey, this looks like a gap in service, or it says here that we can get 100 meg service, but I don't think you offer 100 meg service here. Can you talk to us about that? So really putting the providers on the spot or really inviting them in to be a partner is vitally important. And we've done that across Maine to sort of truth test those maps.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Our next question, Dennis, is for you. And the question is, how does a public organization, such as a public housing agency or authority, which wants to gain broadband access for its residents, but does not have the technical knowledge to assemble a team, what should the specific process or players should be contacted to develop that?
So it begins really with trying to identify who are the key partners and players that you could work with, essentially help identify or fill in some of the gaps. When we talk about, connectivity, especially across a region such as Chula Vista, it's really important to understand, strength areas, weakness areas, and even areas of opportunity in our region. So start off by extending and reaching out to whether it's, the utility providers, community agencies, other agencies such as school districts, water districts. In our case, we have two water districts. And find out what is it that they have, what kind of existing assets do they have that could be left, and then go a step further and benchmark yourself against those other agencies or those cities, and then see essentially what are some areas where you're performing better than they are, they're performing better than you are, and then open up the channel of communication and begin engaging in a very strategic way, looking for specific wins that are either mutually beneficial, but are also helping you accomplish your final goal.
Okay, thank you. Folks, we are up against our allotted 60-minute time limit. I will have one more question for the group. Thank you all for the submission of your questions. We will do our best to get these answered offline. And have them contact you. Again, you can always contact the presenters individually with your questions if they're not answered during this question and answer session. The final question is regarding the the pre-deployment phases. This will be for the broadband networks and how those were funded. The question is how were those funded? I know the Colorado project, or the Cranberry Isles project, I'm sorry, that made reference to the bond offering that was made. But can you both speak to how each project will fund or has funded that pre-deployment phase for your projects?
Would you like me to start for this, Jim?
Yes, please.
We are funding the project that was approved through a vote of town voters at an annual town meeting. We've bonded the project. We're doing it as we go in phases, and so we're basically funding it ourselves. We did seek a grant through the USDA. We weren't successful in getting that grant, but we knew going into the whole project that that was certainly a possibility. We knew that we would have to fund it ourselves through local tax dollars, through the town tax dollars. And that's what we've chosen to do. We have a fairly, as Mark mentioned, a fairly low interest rate. I believe it's under 3%, between 2 and 3%, which is standard for the community for any borrowing that we do. We have the capacity to do it, so that's what we chose to do through funding it through tax dollars. And we have a 10-year, it'll be a 10-year payoff on that loan from the bank.
Yeah, and this is Kara from Pitkin County. So from our perspective, Pitkin County voters actually have a property mill levy that has traditionally funded a TV FM translator system. And so when I referenced the 2011 kind of was the start of the project, the voters, the electorate chose to expand the use of that mill levy to not only run the translator system, but also used for the exploration of broadband and wireless services. That mill levy is pretty minor in the scheme of things, but what it did provide was that seed money to do matching to a state grant fund. So the state a few years ago had earmarked a funding source for broadband services, and we were able to use the funding from that mill levy as matching dollars to a grant to receive a funding grant from the state, and that was about a $150,000 funding grant that we used for infrastructure inventory of the region, residential surveys to understand kind of what the actual landscape was out there, as well as then the conceptual model of the middle mile microwave network.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank everyone for your questions. You know, obviously, with the time limit, we could not get to all of the questions, but really appreciate your attendance today. As we conclude, I want to remind you all that Broadband USA's Practical Conversation webinars are scheduled for the third Wednesday of each month at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Please join us again on Wednesday, April 18th. For our webinar on smart state initiatives. Finally, Broadband USA is available to provide technical assistance to help expand broadband connectivity, promote digital inclusion, and broadband adoption. For more information, please email us at broadbandusa@ntia.doc.gov, or you may visit our website for more information. And don't forget to access our free toolkits, publications, and informational resources. Thank you all, and have a great afternoon.